Well, if you're following in a Bible, we're in that passage that we read together, 1 Samuel and chapter 2. And in that chapter I have a text, which is the latter half of verse 30. Them that honour me, I will honour, and they that despise me shall be lightly esteemed. Them that honour me, I will honour, and they that despise me shall be lightly esteemed. Some of you may have heard of Eric Liddell. He was a missionary in China in his later years. But in his youth, he was a considerable athlete. And in fact, he was so good that he was due to run in the 1924 Olympic Games. And he was quite famous, particularly for his running speed, and everybody was expecting that he would win the 100 meters race in that 1924 Olympic Games. But when it came to the runoff heats, you know, they have heats beforehand to filter out the slower people, and then they just have the fastest people in the final race. The heats were on Sunday, and so he refused to run. Everybody had been expecting this to be a remarkable race, a remarkable event. Everybody knew that he was bound to win the race. He was so fast, he was unapproachable. But he said, no, I'm a Christian. I'm not going to run on the Lord's Day. So he didn't run. And a lot of people were let down, especially the English team. Anyhow, because he had been entered for the 100 meters and was so, everyone was so confident he was going to win it, they'd put him in for the 400 meters as well, but it really wasn't his distance. But anyhow, he was there and he hadn't run. And the time came for the 400 meters. And as he left the British hotel where the team was staying to go to the racetrack for the 400 meters, someone slipped a piece of paper into his hand. He didn't have a chance to look at it until just before the race. And just before the race, he opened the piece of paper, and what he found written on it were the words of our text. Them that honour me, I will honour, and they that despise me shall be lightly esteemed. And he said afterwards that it really galvanised him. He'd never run like that before. 400 metres were not his distance, but he won it in a world record time, and it made headlines. What does the text say? Them that honour me, I will honour, and they that despise me shall be lightly esteemed. And someone, doesn't know who, someone had written that down for him, put it into his hand just before the race. Well, that's the text that I want to look at in our passage. And this passage seems to be structured to throw up the two families, Elkanah and Hannah on the one side and Eli's family on the other side, to show the contrast between the two families, a family that honored God and a family that didn't honor God, a family that God blessed and a family that God didn't bless. So the whole passage is, if you like, a graphic illustration of our text. Them that honour me, I will honour, and they that despise me shall be lightly esteemed. So in verse 11, we hear that Samuel ministered before the Lord. Samuel ministered before the Lord. You find that also in verses 18 and 26. But then in verses 12 to 17, we're looking at Eli's family. And we find that Hophni and Phinehas, his sons, they sin before the Lord. Samuel served before the Lord. Hophni and Phinehas sin before the Lord. Look at verse 17. Therefore the sin of the young men was very great before the Lord. The sin of the young men was very great before the Lord. Samuel served before the Lord. Hophni and Phinehas sinned before the Lord. And then we come to verses 18 to 21. And we read something about Elkanah's family, how godly they were, and the way in which godly family that they were, the Lord blessed them. And then we go on to verses 22 to 36, and we find out something about Eli's family, how they were a God-dishonoring family, and how God punished them for that. So the passage goes back and forth between Elkanah and his family, Eli and his family, a God-honoring family, a God-dishonoring family, a family that God blessed, a family that God judged. So that's the pattern of what we're going to be looking at tonight. What I want to do is, first of all, look at the house of Eli, let's see something about them, and then we'll go on to look at the house of Elkanah, his family. And then thirdly, I want to ask the question, well, what does that mean for us? What does this text mean for us? This is Old Testament. We're in the New Testament times. What does this text, they that honor me, I will honor, and they that despise me. Yeah. So that's the pattern of what I want to do with you tonight. So let's start off by looking at Eli's family. In Exodus chapter 29 and verse 9, there's no need to turn to it, the Lord promised that Aaron's descendants would be a continuing priesthood, a sort of hereditary priesthood. And that's confirmed with an oath in Numbers 20:25. And Eli was a descendant of the younger son of Aaron from Thamar. He wasn't a descendant of the older son, Eleazar. He was a descendant of the younger son. And so, presumably at this time, for some reason, the descendants of the older son were unable to serve in the priesthood. At this point in their descent, for some reason, they couldn't serve in the priesthood. And therefore, it fell to Eli. And Eli, therefore, was the high priest and judge in Israel at this time. His sons, Hophni and Phinehas, they were, therefore, by birth, they were destined to become priests and were indeed serving in that office at this time. But we read in verse 12 that these two boys were sons of Belial. They knew not the Lord. There was evil about them. Working as priests, in the office of priests, and yet they were sons of Belial. They knew not the Lord. It was a corrupt priesthood. Heirs apparent to the high priesthood, but corrupt priests. And we have some examples in this chapter which tell us the sort of things that they did. In Leviticus chapters 1 to 7, we have in great detail what was to happen to the offerings, what the priests who had to live of the offerings, what they were allowed to have, and what was sacred to the Lord, only the Lord could have. And we read, as we read the passage together, we read of the way in which Hophni and Phinehas would send their servants, and they'd come with this three-pronged fork and stick it into the melting pot when an offering was being boiled, and whatever it pulled out, they would have undoubtedly many meats that weren't that were forbidden to them, but they would insist on having them, things which were reserved for the Lord. But they would insist on having them. And then, in particular, we find that they wanted to have the fat. Now, the fat was reserved for the Lord. It had to be burned. No one was allowed to have that. And yet, they wanted roasted meat. They wanted the fat. They weren't satisfied with just boiled meat. And the punishment to someone who took the fat that was reserved for the Lord was death. They should have been condemned to death for doing what they did. And so we read in verse 17 that the sins of the young man was very great. Wherefore the sin of the young man was very great before the Lord, for man abhorred the offering of the Lord. It was brought into disrepute. The common image that was spread amongst the people was that it was nothing. See how the priest's servants are sent to collect things for the priests. See how casually they treat the whole situation. And that was the sort of influence that they were having. And it was worse than that. If you look at verse 22. Now Eli was very old and heard all that his sons did unto all Israel, and how they lay with the women that assembled at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. Evidently there were women who were assembling there, which was quite common in heathen temples, prostitutes and people like that. And they would have immoral relationships with these people. All of this Eli heard about. He heard about it. And what was he to do? That was the great issue. What would he do about these things? Well, we read in verses 23 to 25 that he tried to restrain them. Look at verse 23. And he said unto them, "Why do ye such things? For I hear of your evil deeds by all the people." Everybody was talking about the immorality that these sons, these priests, were showing. The way in which they were playing fast and loose with the offerings and the relationships with the women at the tent door. He heard about it, and Eli said to them, "Why do you these things? For I hear of your evil dealings by all this people. Nay, my sons, for it is no good report that I hear. Ye make the Lord's people to transgress." Priests making the Lord's people to transgress. That was the measure of what was going on in Eli's family, what was happening in Eli's family. But then in verse 25, we read that notwithstanding, halfway through the verse, notwithstanding, they hearkened not unto the voice of their father, because the Lord would slay them. They didn't listen. They wanted it their own way. They made light of the things of God. We're not told very much about the early years in Eli's family. We're not told very much about how he disciplined his children, or didn't discipline them, as the case may be. But you remember how in Proverbs 22 we're told, "Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old he will not depart from it." Maybe there'd been a lack in that early discipline in the family, but for whatever reason these sons were out of control, and Eli could see it. He was aware of it, but he had no power now. They were fully grown men. There was no power. They took no notice of what he had to say. But all was not lost, because under Israeli law at that time, he had a recourse. He could report his sons to the elders amongst them, the rulers amongst them, and they would be judged. And they could, in extreme cases, they could condemn unruly sons to death. So Eli could have done this. But he loved his sons. And see, the stress that he was under, what was he to do? He's torn between his love for his sons and his love for the Lord, for Eli was a God-fearing man. And what he did was nothing. If you look at verse 29 of our chapter, when this man of God came and spoke to Eli, he says there, "Wherefore kick ye at my sacrifice?" The sacrifice, he doesn't value it. What was happening? The sacrifice, the worship of Israel, is being made a mockery of. "Wherefore kick ye at my sacrifice and at mine offering, which I have commanded in my habitation, and honorest thy sons above me, to make yourselves fat with the chiefest of all the offerings of Israel, my people." The sons were feeding off the best of the offerings that people brought to the Lord. They were craving off the best things, the fat and the forbidden meats. They were taking them and just making a mockery of what was intended for the Lord. And here's this man of God, and he comes to Eli, and he says, "Well, why are you doing this? Why are you putting your sons above me? Wherefore kick ye at my sacrifice and at mine offerings, which I have commanded in my habitation, and honorest thy sons above me, to make yourselves fat with the chiefest of all the offerings of Israel, my people? So that was where Eli fell short. That was the accusation that was against him. And it's repeated in chapter 3, verse 13. We shall come to that next time. For I have told him that I will judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knoweth, because his sons made themselves vile, and he restrained them not. That was where Eli fell short, a failure to discipline his children. Maybe the battle had been lost when they were young in the home, but for whatever reason, as grown men, he failed to discipline them. He had the recourse to the elders of the city to have them judged and dealt with, but he didn't do it because he prized his sons above the sacrifice. What a message. What a family. What a problem. Well, this man of God comes to Eli, comes to this family that is not honoring him. Remember our text. They that honor me, I will honor, and they that despise me shall be lightly esteemed. The family had brought the worship into disrepute, the offerings, the immoral behavior. And so now this man of God comes, and he brings a message from the Lord. It comes in five parts. In verse 31, the arm of the family, its authority. He was the high priest. He was the judge. That would be cut off. Verse 31, behold, the days come that I will cut off thine arm and the arm of thy father's house. He would lose his authority. Secondly, we go on in verse 31. And there shall not be an old man in thy house, and thou shalt see an enemy in my habitation in all the wealth which God shall give Israel, and there shall not be an old man in thine house forever. And the man of thine whom I shall cut off from mine altar shall be to consume thine eyes and to grieve thine heart, and all the increase of thine house shall die in the flower of their age. From now on, the family would die young. And it's interesting, there's a man called Bishop Patrick who's actually traced this history, and Eli's descendants did from then on begin to die very young. That was the second thing. Thirdly, the descendants would have to rely upon the charity of the new priests. Verse 36, and it shall come to pass that everyone that is left in thine house shall come and crouch to him for a piece of silver and a morsel of bread, and shall say, put me, I pray thee, into one of the priest's offices, that I may eat a piece of bread. So first of all, the priestly authority he would lose. Secondly, he and his descendant, or his descendants, would die young. Thirdly, they'd be reduced to being beggars. And then fourthly, we're told that Hophni and Phinehas would die almost immediately. They would die young. Verse 34, and this shall be a sign unto thee that shall come upon thy two sons, on Hophni and Phinehas. In one day they shall die, both of them. And then fifthly, God would raise up a new high priest. Verse 35, and I will raise me up a faithful priest that shall do according to that which is in mine heart and in my mind. And I will build him a sure house, and he shall walk before mine anointed forever. And that again did actually happen. For example, in the time of David, Zadok was the priest, and he was a descendant of Moses' oldest son. It did actually switch back to the older of Moses' descendants. Of Aaron's descendants, sorry. So what a story. Eli, basically a God-fearing man, and yet because of neglect in the home, brought to judgment. And the family is brought low. Because God has this principle, the principle of our text. Them that honour me, I will honour. And they that despise me shall be lightly esteemed. So it even happened to Eli's family. Now let's come to Elkanah and Hannah. You remember in the previous chapter, on previous occasions, we've seen how Hannah was childless and longing for a child. And she was in the temple weeping. And Eli saw her and they had that conversation. And she explained that she wasn't intoxicated. She was pleading with the Lord that she might one day have a son. And God gave her her son. God gave her her son. She called him Samuel, which literally means asked of the Lord. And she promised to give him back to the Lord. If you look at chapter 1 and verse 22. But Hannah went not up. This is after Samuel was born. Hannah went not up, for she said unto her husband, I will not go up until the child is weaned, and then I will bring him, that he may appear before the Lord, and there abide forever. Now, can you imagine that? Here's Hannah. She'd longed for a child. Remember again the episode when she was weeping in the temple and Eli spoke with her. And God answered her prayer. And now she had this child in her arms. Prayer had been answered. And what does she do? She gives it back to the Lord. Can you imagine the cost to her? And what we find in this chapter is that she kept her promise. She kept her promise. If you look at verse 19, the mother made him a little coat and brought it to him from year to year when she came up with her husband to offer the yearly sacrifice. She did all that she could. As a mother at a distance, it's only about where they lived. If you look at a map, it's only about 10 miles from Jerusalem. It was not that far. She perhaps went on other occasions, but this was a God-fearing family, and they came up annually to the time of sacrifice. And each time she came, and she brought him a new little coat to fit him as he was growing larger. And then we read in verse 26, the child Samuel grew on and was in favour, both with the Lord and also with men. What a contrast with Hophni and Phinehas. In favour with the Lord and with men. He grew and he served before the Lord. And now God honours this family. This God-fearing family. Remember our text. We're told in our text. He that honoureth me, I will honour. And they that despise me shall be lightly esteemed. And God honours her. Look at verse 26. The child Samuel grew and was in favour with God, both with the Lord and with men. And then, if you go back to verse 21, and the Lord visited Hannah, so that she conceived and bare 3 sons and 2 daughters, and the child Samuel grew before the Lord. See the difference between the two families. Eli's family, Hophni and Phinehas, dishonoring the Lord. And the man of God comes with that fivefold judgment upon the family. But then we've got Elkanah and Hannah and Samuel growing before the Lord, given back to the Lord. And the Lord blesses this family. 3 more sons and 2 more daughters. How good God is. But let's ask thirdly, what does this text mean for us? Is this a principle by which God deals with us in New Testament times? We've seen the judgment upon Eli's family. We've seen the blessing upon Elkanah's family. Can we expect that in our day? Them that honor me, I will honor, and they that despise me shall be lightly esteemed. I want to take you to two New Testament passages as we try to answer this question. What does this mean for us today? First of all, concerning the long-term implication of this principle, them that honor me, I will honor, in eternity. How does it work out in eternity? I want to take you to Luke chapter 19 and the parable of the pounds. Luke chapter 19, and we read in verse 11 that because the disciples or the followers thought that going up to Jerusalem, Jesus would soon establish his kingdom, he therefore told this parable of the pounds. And we read in verse 12 that a certain nobleman went into a far country to receive for himself a kingdom and to return. And clearly the Lord is referring here to himself about going to Jerusalem, going to the cross, going to glory. But then one day to return, one day to come back again. A certain nobleman went into a far country to receive for himself a kingdom and to return. And then in verse 13 we see how he took 10 pounds and gave a pound to each of his servants. And then in the fullness of time, the nobleman, having received his kingdom, comes back, obviously referring to the Lord's return and the day of judgment. Verse 15, it came to pass that when he had returned, having received the kingdom, then he commanded these servants to be called unto him, to whom he had given the money, that he might know how much every man had gained by trading. And you remember how it unfolds. The first man comes and says, "Thy pound," verse 16, "hath gained thee 10 pounds. And then in verse 17, "And he said unto this servant, Well, thou good servant, because thou hast been faithful in a very little, have thou authority over 10 cities. He'd been faithful in a very little, just a pound. And the Lord comes back and he's given authority over 10 cities in this new kingdom that he rules over. Very little. This servant, he did very little. But he behaved honorably with what the Lord had entrusted to him. And people will speak about this as the gospel, the thing that everybody receives. Everybody receives the gospel, every believer. If we're faithful with it, the Lord honors those who are faithful in the eternity of the future. But then, perhaps more surprisingly, if you look at Mark chapter 10, you find out how this works out in time before judgment day. Mark chapter 10 and verse 28. "Then Peter began to say unto the Lord, Lo, we have left all and have followed thee. And Jesus answered, verily, I say unto you, there is no man that hath left house, or brethren, or sisters, or father, or mother, or wife, or children, or lands, for my sake and the gospel's, but he shall receive 100-fold now in this time, houses, and brethren, and sisters, and mothers, and children, and lands." Isn't that amazing? The principle that we've been looking at, them that honor me, I will honor. And here are two New Testament passages which point, one to the eternity of the future and the other to this present time. And we see that the Lord is no man's debtor. Isn't that amazing? That God is willing to stoop down and provide for his faithful servants in this glorious way. So, how do we stand? Them that honour me, I will honour. Those who are willing to trust, believe that the Lord can be trusted to care for them, to provide for them, to venture upon him, to invest in him, he will honour. I'm often struck by the thought that when we fail to venture upon the Lord's promises, we're essentially saying to him, I don't trust you. I don't believe you. You make great promises, but I don't believe you can deliver. That's to dishonour the Lord. Them that honour me, those that count me worthy of their trust, of their devotion, of their love, of their service, of their witness, I will honour. And those that despise me, those that give no thought to my commandments, those that give no thought to trusting me, those who venture in their own strength because they will not trust me, I will lightly esteem. Isn't God's goodness amazing? It says there in that passage we looked at in Mark that he restores 100-fold. What an amazing God we have. How amazing his provision, his care for me. Them that honour me, the great God who made this world, who is all-knowing and all-wise, all-powerful, is prepared to say to us, little creatures, sinful creatures, you honour me, and I'll honour you more than you could ever imagine. I'll provide for you, I'll watch over you. He's no man's debtor. Let's ask this question then. How do we begin? How do we begin to honour God as he expects us to do? I want to take you to a verse in Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 6. Without faith, it is impossible to please him. For he that cometh to God must believe that he is, and that he is the rewarder of them that diligently seek him. Those opening phrases. Without faith, it is impossible to please him. We have to begin where he begins with us. When he points to us and says, you're a sinner, venture upon me, venture upon my provision at Calvary, then begin to live a life of faith. It's no good living a glorious life of good works, because without faith, it is impossible to please him. So if we would know something of the Lord's blessing, them that honour me, I will honour, his wonderful provision, that he is no man's debt, if we would know anything of any of these things, We have to begin where he begins. The issue of faith. Do we trust him? Do we trust him with our never dying souls? Trust him to deal with the matter of sin that rages within our beings? Are we prepared to venture upon him for the well-being of our souls in the eternity of the future? Then begin to live the life of faith. But oh, what a glorious life it can be. Them that honour me, I will honour. Almighty God says, them that honour me, I will honour. Oh, that we might all of us know much of the Lord's provision, his care, his watching over us, his provision for us. It's interesting that if you go to the book of Revelation, you find that God's honour is central to the worship. Revelation chapter 4 and verse 11. Here we find the 24 elders bowing down before the throne. They cry out, "Thou art worthy, O Lord, to receive glory and honour and power. For thou hast created all things, and for thy pleasure they are and were created." The theme of heaven is that God is worthy of the honour of all of heaven. But he looks to you, for you to add to that honour. And we find that as you go on into chapter 5, verse 11, "And behold, I heard the voice of many angels round about the throne, the beasts and the elders, and the number of them was 10,000 times 10,000, and thousands of thousands, saying with a loud voice, 'Worthy is the Lamb that was slain to receive power and riches and wisdom and strength and honour and glory and blessing.' And every creature which is in heaven and on earth and under the earth, such as are in the sea and all that are in them, heard I saying, 'Blessing and honour and glory and power be unto him that sitteth upon the throne, and unto the Lamb, for ever and ever. Amen.'" The theme of heaven. And it's to be the theme in your life, if you're a believer, and in my life. It's what God expects of us. But he's no man's debtor. Them that honour me, I will honour. Let's all pray. Oh, gracious God, we do confess that we fail so often to honour thee, to venture upon thee, to trust thee, to cast our burdens upon thee, knowing that thou art all sufficient. Oh, forgive us, Father, for the weakness of our faith, for we remind ourselves without faith it's impossible to please God. Oh, then, Father, help us. Help us in this life of faith to grow, to venture upon thee, to cast all before thee, that we might glorify thee, that we might join the songs of heaven. Thou art worthy to receive blessing and honour and glory and power, for thou hast created all things for honour. They are and were created. Help us, Father, we pray, in our Saviour's name. Amen.